Chapter 6. As Bill was saying, we're getting close to home. Very close to home. The American Revolution was fought over the subject of property. Today, the subject of property seems to be one that is not talked about much in government circles in terms of private property, certainly. They've pretty much, many of them at the top level, I think, decided that it isn't much of an issue. They control it all. But contrary to what many might think, this is a very central issue to our nation and should be to all Christians. Unfortunately, many Christians have developed a pie-in-the-sky attitude toward property and toward the whole area of free enterprise and productivity and dominion over the earth, as we were talking about this morning. And as a result, the Christians who once were the by far the most productive people that the world had ever known, because they had applied the Puritan work ethic to their life and to their businesses and had become the most productive and wealthy individuals the world had known, had slipped in, as we moved into the 20th century, had slipped into kind of a slipshod attitude toward business and toward property. I'm not saying all Christians, but many Christians did. I believe there was a reason for that. I believe that we're dealing with that reason here in chapter 6. It's a theological reason. And the reason comes down to a fundamental view of who God is and His sovereignty. Is God sovereign over all of life, including our finances and including our businesses? And is He interested in it? Is that an important area to Him? Or is the spiritual part of life, meaning this concept that, you know, the pie in the sky, heavenly concepts are the really important ones and the physical down here is unimportant, is that what should dominate our time and our life? The problem with drawing the dichotomy between the two is that the minute you draw the dichotomy, you prove yourself to be a Neoplatonist. You prove that you have in your own mind divided up life between the spiritual and the sacred. And in God's mind, there is no separation. That God is interested in both the physical and the spiritual, as we were saying this morning. As we look at chapter 6, we see that it starts out by talking about who owns you and your property. Very important question. Does God own you? Does Satan own you? Or does the state own you? How we answer that question is going to determine what happens in America in the very, very near future. Because it is property, both internal property and external property, that is used by either good people or bad people to move out and make the movies, do the videotapes, control the education, write the books, do all of the things that are done that literally control the minds and hearts of men and determine the future course of nations. So what happens with property is vital and it is important, contrary to what many socialist Christians would try to tell us today. Look at the worldview that's presented on page 106, if you would. Up until about 100 years ago, the worldview of the Reformation was dominant in America. If you look at the circle on the right-hand side of the page, you'll notice that what our founding fathers believed was that God was sovereign over all of life. As a result, who was the present king of this world? There's only one. His name is King Jesus. He is the ruler of this present age. And if you want verses for that, Revelation 1:5, we can go right through. Look at the end of each one of Paul's epistles and you'll see to whom glory and dominion. Glory and dominion belongs to who? You know, who is the ruler of the world? Who will all things be subdued to in 1 Corinthians 15? Jesus Christ. He's the ruler of this world, and they saw Jesus ruling through His Bible, His written word, through the self-governing Christian who then took that written word and lived his life accordingly. And then, by God, through His word, dividing up the sovereignty of various institutions. What I mean by that is sphere sovereignty. There are various spheres of authority. In government, there's a sphere of authority in economics, a sphere of authority for the family, a sphere of authority for the church. And God has divided up authority so that He alone has ultimate sovereignty, and there are sphere areas of authority that are delegated by God to those specific institutions. God saw His word as being the dominant law, word to each one of those spheres. And the self-governing Christian was to be the intermediary who was to, in love, apply God's word and God's law to each one of those spheres. Satan was not the ruler of this world, meaning this cosmos, this land. They didn't see Satan as owning one inch of this land. This land and all that is in it, including the air that we breathe, including everything that's been created, belongs to God Almighty, never did and never will belong to the devil. And yet, there are many who have perverted, including myself 15 years ago, perverted the words in the book of John and some other places where they'll say, well, wait a minute, now we have Satan is the ruler of this age. Is he not? Is he not the prince of the power of the air in Ephesians chapter 2? And were we not once under his control as sons of disobedience? Yes, that's right. He is the prince of the power of the air. He is control of the sons of disobedience. And he does control the world system that is doing battle with Jesus and with his people. But he does not control the world. He controls a system, which is simply a group of reprobates, both demons and individuals who are reprobates who turn their back upon God. And that world system is doing battle with God, but God controls the world and all that is in it. This is a very important distinction, because to understand God as king of the world is to understand that this world is important to God, and that he owns it, controls it, and expects us to go out there and to till the land and to be productive and to use that productivity to his glory. If the devil owns the world, then who cares? If he owns it, why should we even get involved? Why don't we all just take a rented apartment and as cheap a one as we can get, since we've got to pay our rent to the devil anyway? And why should we build beautiful homes? And why should we build businesses? And why should we put down roots? And why should we have heritage? And why should we even have children? And in fact, there are many Christians today who are questioning that. I have to counsel young people all the time who are talking to me about, Marshall, should I get married? The Lord's coming anyway. Should I get married? Everything's falling apart. There isn't any hope. There's no reason for me to get married. And I have to go back to the Dominion mandate, and it says there, be fruitful and multiply. And I say, get married and get to work. Because the way I've seen it, the best disciples we're going to have are the little ones that were standing up here in this stage. There's where we get disciples. We get it out of the womb of our wife. That's the best disciple there ever was. Much better than trying to pick one up that's 40 years in humanism and is going to have a twitch for the next 20. But you know, you see what I'm saying about the worldview of the 20th century Christian? Have you ever been told this by some religious person? And usually it's a pastoral type like myself. You know, I come in and say, oh, my beloved brethren, we know that there's evil out there, and we want you to bring your filthy lucre in, and we're going to make it holy. Now, I'm not saying all pastors do that, but there's a tendency for we religious types to somehow make things holy when they're in the church, and then out there, you know, we got the filthy lucre layman who's got to be out there dealing with money, but, you know, now we're into spiritual things, and we're going to spiritualize it all, and yeah, you know, all that's important is the spiritual. Wait a minute, there is no dichotomy here. That when I'm out there working daily, I'm doing just as important a spiritual labor as that pastor is doing when he's studying his Bible. That all things are holy unto God, and that dollar bill is no more holy or unholy, depending on who holds it. It's a matter of how it is used. Okay? That is just a tool that is to be used to judge your productivity is really all that thing should be. And unfortunately, they've debased it to such an extent that it's not even that anymore. But the point is that God is in control of the world. If you see that, then your view toward property is going to be correct. Look on the left-hand side of the page there on page 60, page 106. Notice that the world is controlled by Satan, according to many, many modern Christians. The state is corrupt and can be expected to control. Many Christians think, well, you see, what can we expect? It's evil. I've heard Christians come to me, I'd never let my son go into politics. It's a dirty business. It's dirty stuff. I wouldn't get involved. You know, the devil's in control of all governments, you know. And when you begin to talk that way, you've just cut yourself out of the world. You've just sawed a little hole around you, and you just dropped out of the world scene. You are useless. You are good for nothing. You are salt that has lost its savor. And that's what the Christian community, for the most part, has done with itself for about 100 years. We cut a hole around ourselves and said, we're not interested in that because that's not holy. Well, the reason it isn't holy is because we're not in there making it holy. Hallelujah, isn't it? And then the worldview of the good old humanist down here, we don't really bother with him. We know where he's coming from. He basically says man is sovereign, the strongest are, you know, survival of the fittest, the strongest will dominate, and basically the church can go hang. And that's exactly what they'll do. If you see God ruling the earth, look on page 107, you see the commission is to subdue the earth, to build godly nations, to evangelize. You see Christian culture is leavening all areas of life. You see the world as his, and every activity is religious. And you see reformation and productivity and free enterprise as being the future hope for your children. Now, if you see Satan ruling the world, then what do you think? Well, you think that your commission is just to save souls from an evil world. It's so evil, you better save them quick. So you better, you know, don't build a relationship with that neighbor. Just quickly go over there and say, you dirty drunk, repent, you know. You've only got today, it could be tomorrow, you know. Now, there's a sense in which there's an urgency, and that's absolutely right. But let's use a little wisdom in the way we reach out. If the Lord owns the world, then we can relax in his sovereignty and say, you're in control. If it's the devil owns it all, then we're in a sense of constant panic because everything around us is controlled by the evil one. Church activity is primary and spiritual while worldly pursuits are secular. So being involved in the area of property and issues like that, or how could you be so worldly as to be interested in those kinds of things, you see? Reformation is impossible since things must get worse. So the worse they are, the better that is. Taxation goes up, that's okay. Render under Caesar the things that are Caesar's. So you can see that your worldview as it relates to who is sovereign over your property is a very, very important question. It was a very important question to our founding fathers. They believed the issue of property was so important that they were willing to go to war over it. The battle cry of the American Revolution as they gathered around the Liberty Tree was life, liberty, and property. Life, liberty, and property. And they would die for all three. See? And there are a lot of Christians say, yes, I could see dying for life and liberty, but property, those are things, those are cars, and you wouldn't die for that. That's not spiritual. And they understood property in a different context. You see, John Locke, who was the philosopher of the American Revolution, and the one that was read by our American Revolutionary forefathers, he understood the concept that property was both internal to external, and so did men like James Madison. If you look on page 112, John Locke, in one of his treatises, in the top of page 112, says, "For men, being all the workmanship of one omnipotent and infinite wise maker, all the servants of one sovereign master, sent into the world by his order and about his business, they are his property, whose workmanship they are, made at last during his, not one another's, pleasure. We are created by God. He has given us dominion over certain works of his hands, and we are accountable to him. We are owned by him." Our founding fathers, our pilgrims would have been able to quote it, chapter and verse. Wait a minute. I've been bought with a price, okay? And I am no man's slave, but I am a slave of Jesus Christ. You see? The difference is that I am a free man under God. I am not a slave to you. And they understood that concept. To take away a man's property, as our founding fathers saw it, was to take away his dignity and was to take away part of him, because it was a part of what God had given him. When you take away a part of man's productivity, you take away what he is to be tithing to God, what he is to be using for God, that entire 100% of whatever it is that God has allowed him to be productive in. So as you rape it from him, you are taking it from God, and he sees it that way if he properly understands God and government and property. That's how our founding fathers understood it. On page 113, listen to what James Madison says. "Property in the former sense is a man's land or merchandise or money, and it is called his property. In the latter sense, a man has a property in his opinions and the free communication of them. He has a property in a peculiar value in his religious opinions and in the profession and practice dictated by them. He has an equal property in the free use of his faculties and the free choice of the objects on which to employ them. In a word, as a man is said to have a right in his property, he may be equally said to have a property in his rights. Government is instituted to protect property of every sort. Conscience is the most sacred of all property." Interesting statements, aren't they? You see, James Madison understood something, and that is that once we compromised the property of our conscience, it would only be a matter of time before we would compromise and give up our external property. You know, it was Thomas Jefferson that said that the American Constitution and Republic would only last as long as it takes for the American people to figure out how to pilfer the public trough and that's just about it. It took us a few, 100 years or so to figure out how that a minority of the people could rape the rest of the people of their productivity, and that's where our republic began to be siphoned off in terms of its productivity. But that siphoning of tax dollars beginning in 1913 was the result of the fact that we as Christians had already compromised our internal conscience in many other areas. We had already given over our children to statist education. We had already began the process of living a socialist type lifestyle and depending more on government and having less dependence upon God and being less self-governing. And as that process of disintegration in our own area of self-government as it related to our own property, internal property, as that began to diminish, it was only natural that evil forces would move in and fill the vacuum and take up the property that we were giving up voluntarily. Beginning with our conscience, and then beginning with our children, and then eventually getting down to our property. Isn't it interesting that a man cries the most about it when somebody grabs his pocketbook, but he doesn't cry too hard when someone grabs his children? It's a commentary on our day that we allow our children to be polluted by pornography and all the junk around us, that we're allowing that by the fact that we haven't taken a strong enough stand. And yet, when the pocketbook is attacked, men scream, because it seems to be the closest thing to many of the American people's mind. This is important. I'm not saying it's not important, but I'm saying if you let the children go and you let the conscience go and you've compromised, you get yourself in such a guilty position that you are in no position to take a stand. Remember we were saying earlier, the communists want to get us demoralized. So immoral and ungodly in our own minds and thoughts that we can't take a stand in the areas that are important to us, including taxation and without representation and other areas. Conscience is so important. Madison was saying then that man has a property in his person, man has a property in the free use of his faculties, and that conscience is the most sacred of all property. And as a result, the American Revolution was fought over a simple 3% tax on tea. You think today, here we are sitting with a 40 to 50% tax burden or better, and the Roman Empire fell with a 20% tax burden, and the American Revolution was fought over a 3% tax on tea. And here we are sitting around saying, well, I don't know, that's the price of living in a good society like ours. They do have to pay for those roads up and down I-5, That's worth at least 50% of my income. Hey, smart. We're real smart. But better days are coming because we're coming back to understand the importance of property. Property from God's perspective, a man's productivity. And there are millions of Christians who are reading and studying now about the biblical principles of free enterprise. Is there a biblical form of enterprise and the use of property? There sure is. The Virginians found out in the early years how not to do it through communism. So did the Pilgrims. But it took them a while to reason it through. Isn't it sad that we have to go back in this generation and relearn those same lessons? The Puritan work ethic, which was taught to us by our Puritan forefathers from about 1620 right on through, made our nation the most productive nation the world has ever known. Do you know that in England, the Puritans were 4% of the population and yet controlled almost 50% of the wealth of England? 4% of the population. Now, how did they get it? They weren't the aristocrats and they weren't born into wealth. They got it because they used the Puritan work ethic. What was that? Frugality, honesty, tithing, saving, okay? Creativity, individual creativity, voluntary union with other Christians, respect for another man's property, not lying, integrity, hard work. Those basic ethics that we now you don't hear much of are the basic ethics that built the free enterprise system and made America the most productive nation and people the world has ever known. Now that's talked down on in many schools. Oh, come on, the old Puritan work ethic. Look at him, bigoted Puritan type, see? And yet that's the very thing that makes us productive, and that's the thing that's going to pull us out of our economic malaise. Not a greater national debt, not more government spending, but more productivity on the part of Christian men and women who begin to go out there and in a self-governing way begin their own businesses and be productive and do what God's called them to do. That's happening. It's happening again today. But I want you to see that as we go back in American history, that they faced a period just like ours. Sometimes American history is taught as though in those days it was easy. And in those days, they had it easy. Free enterprise was a piece of cake. But what I want you to see is that wasn't the case. They had it difficult, too. They had times of sacrifice and times when free enterprise didn't work. Let's take the American Revolution as an example. You want to talk about a time of being selfish. At about the time of the American Revolution, the American states specifically and many of the American people were very selfish. Do you know that only about 15% of the American people even got involved in the American Revolution? And about 70% of the people sat in the middle and said, who's going to win? I'm going to put my vote toward them. You know, and then there's about another 10% on the other side who were Tories and they were for the British. So you only had about 15 or 20% of the people that were active and involved in the revolution. Of those even 15 or 20%, many of them wouldn't support George Washington and the American army, and so they had to go around barefooted, as you remember, at Valley Forge and throughout the war, because the states couldn't raise enough money or wouldn't raise enough money to even pay for the army to protect their own liberty. So George was in a constant fundraising battle, trying to get enough money to get bullets to defeat the British. They were in a constant state of lack of arms. And yet, what happened was that God, by his providence, because of the self-sacrifice of some free enterprisers, was able to restore the country and save the nation. You know, America was saved and was really, the American Revolution was won, not by an army, but by a group of farmers and artisans, just like the people that are here right now. Do you know that on Lexington Green, on April 18th of 1775, the group of men that stood there were all men that had never shot a man in their life. And those men stood there defending their town, and there were only 70 of them lined up from about here to the end of that wall. And there were 300 British regulars with cannon and horses, and there were 800 behind them, only 300 of them lined up, in front of 70 farmers and artisans who are lined up in front of their houses with their babies and their wives looking on from the houses in the rear. And their pastor, Jonas Clark, was standing next to the green directing his men. And the American men, these farmers and artisans, were willing to give up their lives to say, thus far and no further, if they want to have a war, let it begin here. Because when they get to the point where they take away our guns, and they come in and they rape our women and board their troops in our homes, at that point we say, thus far and no further. And those 70 men stood there and were fired upon by the British, and 8 of them lay down mortally wounded, 17 of them. 17 of them wounded, 8 of them died. This is the story goes, Jonas Clark, who was the pastor for 22 years of these men. After this short 10-minute battle, Jonas Clark came up and grabbed the head of one of his dying parishioners, and the wife of the man was standing over her husband weeping, and he looked up at the wife as he was holding the head of this man who was in his parish, and he said, this man died for a great cause. For from today, the death knell of tyranny shall ring into eternity. Jonas Clark had taught that man the importance of Christian self and civil government. He taught that man the importance of living and dying as a free man before God and not allowing his property to be taken away by some king or bishop. And that man was willing to stand up and, if need be, pay the price of his life. And so he did. But Jonas saw the big picture, and I'm sure that man did too. The British paid a terrible price for that. They lost 245 men that afternoon as the Americans, sharpshooters, shot at those men all afternoon and chased them back into Boston. The American Revolution was the story again and again of a small group of ragtag Americans trusting their God and moving ahead. Not only was it the story of a group of farmers, untrained soldiers moving against the most powerful military force the world has ever known, it was the story of a small group of entrepreneurs who paid the price to save America. You know, Robert Morris is a man nobody talks much about, and yet he's a man that had 17 ships that he donated to the American cause. He's the man that put up the money that allowed George Washington to win the Battle of Trenton. He's the man that put up $10,000. He's the man that went over and raised $200,000 of his personal money on his personal credit from the French and came back and paid the American troops just a few weeks before the final battle so the Americans could win the battle to win the American Revolution. Robert Morris died in bankruptcy and was never paid back for all that he did for America. Other men like Governor Nelson, who was the wealthiest man in Virginia, the wealthiest planter, gave up most of his plantations and put $4 million into actually outfitting the entire Virginia militia. General Nelson then was in charge of the Virginia militia, and at the final battle that the Americans had with Cornwallis at Yorktown, he was asked by General Lafayette where to direct the cannon, and he looked up on the hill and he saw the big white mansion that was in Yorktown. That was his mansion. And he said, "I want you to direct your cannon at that mansion, for I do not want one brick standing upon another on my home if an enemy of my country is resting in that home." He paid the price. George Washington worked for 7 years and was not paid for his efforts. He lost not only years on his life, but he lost much of his productivity that he was never able to recover. You see, America was founded by free enterprise entrepreneurs who saw that, yes, property was important. Property was so important that they were willing to use that property to save their liberty. They understood that it wasn't just me and mine and I'm going to get it and keep it. Like, there are many free enterprisers like that. I imagine there are people that have retired to the Northwest who've just kind of got their money somewhere or whatever, and they got a little place and they figure, "I'm just going to hold out to the end and I don't really care on you, and I just hope that me and mine are going to make it." Well, that mentality is not the free enterprise Puritan work ethic that we saw in early America. Exactly the opposite of that. It would be, yes, be productive. Yes, you should have a nice place. Yes, that's great, and be productive and have that. But then reach out and be willing to pay the price to save your liberty. Our question is, are we going to be able to do that same thing in this generation? If we are, we will be successful. Because it's going to take the free enterprises of America to restore this land. This land is not going to be restored by bureaucrats. It's not going to be restored by electing congressmen and senators, as important as that is. The ultimate victory is going to be won by whether or not we, the American Christians, are willing to pay the price to keep our liberty. And the battle is going to be won not in the streets, because it's, you know, fighting M16s and fighter jets and nuclear arms is kind of tough nowadays. I'd hate to see it come to the streets. I don't think the battle is going to be won in the streets. I think it's going to be won in the idea field, in seminars just like this, and in home study groups, and in family discussions, and in churches. That's where the battle's going to be won. We win it or lose it there, and by the time it gets to the battlefield, it is already decided. The providence of God is going to work, but we've got to have a proper relationship to who owns us and our property. And the biblical balance of Christian free enterprise is not me and mine, and it's not Christian socialism, which says, "Well, you're a Christian, why don't you do it for free?" You know, we all love Jesus, and, you know, we all ought to just pool it all in. You know what it says in Acts 4, they had all things in common. So why don't we just take it, and why don't you give up your car and you give up this? We'll all get together and we'll all drive the same car and do the same thing. And, of course, that's what Christian socialism says, and that is nothing more than atheistic communism in a Christian garb, and it is wrong. But so is this, "I got mine, I forget you." Biblical free enterprise is a free enterprise that meets the needs of society and does it voluntarily out of the love of the heart of the individual who is productive enough to reach out to his brother. Let's take a break.